Sutra in 8,000 lines. What do you know about that text? It's one of my favorite sutras. And it's really important, sutras about the emptiness teachings. And this story about Sada Purudita appears at the end of the sutra. It's a kind of, after many, many teachings, this seems to be, the story appears at the end seemingly as an example of somebody who really, really loves these teachings and really, really wants to practice them. The word Sada Purudita, his name, means the ever-weeping. He's the ever-weeping Bodhisattva. When he first hears about these teachings of emptiness and interdependence, when he hears that all dharmas are empty of any substance or any separation, and that therefore it's really just one dharma, which is like no dharmas, that everything is and isn't at the same time, and so it's kind of like a magical apparition. Everything is like that. And therefore, everything is inherently free and perfect. He is deeply moved by this because he realizes that it's this teaching that's going to help him be of ultimate benefit to sentient beings. That is his deepest commitment, his deepest wish, to be of service to sentient beings, to love and protect others. And he knows that this is the teaching that will enable him to do that most effectively. So he resolves right then and there to do whatever he can to find a great teacher who will give him this teaching and transmit it to him. And he hears about a teacher named Dharmagota who lives in the east. So without any hesitation, he takes off in an easterly direction. And he's going and going and going for a while. And it occurs to him at some point that no one told him exactly how far east he's supposed to go. And he has no idea how far east he's supposed to go. So he stops his tracks right in the middle of the road. And he begins to weep. And this is how he gets his name, the Ever Weeping, because he's weeping. Weeping and weeping and weeping. Days go by, months, weeks go by. He just is not eating. He doesn't do anything but weep. He's so bereft because he doesn't know what to do. Finally, somebody happens along and tells him where he needs to go, how far he needs to go. So he stops weeping and he continues. But then again, it suddenly occurs to him that it is customary to make offerings to teachers in order to receive teachings. But he has nothing to offer. He has no money, no possessions, nothing. So what's he going to do? He decides that what he's going to do is sell his own body, because that's the only thing he has. Going to sell his own body to receive funds in order to make offerings. So he goes right to the marketplace to sell his body. He figures maybe he can get so much for his arms, so much for his legs, maybe so much per quart of blood and so on. So he's going around, does anybody want to buy a body, these different body parts? But Mara, you know who Mara is, right? The sort of nemesis of the Buddha. Mara really hates it when anybody has this much sincerity and focus on the Dharma. Mara does not like this. So Mara caused everyone in the marketplace to completely ignore Sada Purudita, not even to, as if he weren't even there. So he goes around, anybody want to buy a body? People aren't even looking at him. And you know what he does when this happens. He starts to weep. And he's weeping and weeping and weeping and weeping. And he doesn't know what to do. Then, suddenly, Chakra, the king of the gods, appears. Chakra is very impressed with the sincere, pure effort of Sataparudita. But Chakra can't really believe that it's real. He wants to test and see, is this really true? Is he really like this? So he turns himself into a young, prosperous young Brahmin who is in the marketplace looking for something that he can use to sacrifice for his family. Sacrifices, and he agrees to buy Sataparudita's body for this sacrifice. And Sataparudita is overjoyed. Finally, someone has listened to him. He can sell him his body. He can make offerings. He can fulfill his desires. So he pulls out a knife and he starts cutting himself up into pieces. Meanwhile, building up overlooking the marketplace, a merchant's daughter is witnessing this whole scene, and she thinks it's a horrible thing. So she rushes down and tells Sataparudita that, oh no, there's no need for you to do all this. I will provide any offerings that are required. And not only that, I will go with you to see this bodhisattva. And not only that, I'll bring my family and 500 servants. We'll all go. And there'll be plenty of offerings. We'll all carry them. Don't worry. So Chakra then restores Sataparudita's body to its normal condition. And off they all go. And eventually they do arrive at the city where Dharmagota lives. And they discover that he has written down the Prajnaparamita teachings. He's written them in gold ink, a gold leaf. And he's taken these teachings and he's placed them high up in a sacred tower. And there they are, in the tower. So Sataparudita and the whole retinue offer incense and make prostrations and worship this tower, requesting teachings, chanting. And this finally causes Bodhisattva Dharmagata to come out of the sacred building and give a teaching about how Buddhas neither come nor go. That's what Tathagata means. Because suchness neither comes nor goes, neither appears nor disappears, and that the nature of all dharmas is that they are unproduced. This is a very shorthand synopsis of many, many pages in the sutra. He says this at great length. So at this point, there's a tremendous earthquake, and the whole earth shakes in six different ways. And the reason this happens, the Bodhisattva Dharmagata says, is because countless beings have, listening to him, actually achieved patient acceptance of dharmas that fail to be produced. And that's why the earth responds with this fantastic earthquake. Now this phrase is one of my favorite phrases in all of I think everything you ever need to know about the practice is included in this phrase. Patient acceptance of dharmas that fail to be produced. This is how we can receive and understand and bear the suffering of the world. Patient acceptance of dharmas that fail to be produced. Hearing this, Sataparudita becomes joyful and zestful and so happy and so excited. He is so excited, so happy, so overjoyed that he begins to spontaneously levitate. And he flies into the air, it says in the sutra, to a height of 7 palm trees. From that height, he hurls down mandarava flowers on the bodhisattva Dharmogata, who accepts these gifts of flowers, and then turns around, goes into his meditation house, where he does a retreat for 7 years, during which time he remains in one continuous state of samadhi. While Dharmagata is in retreat, Sataparuddha practices sitting and walking meditation. He never lies down, just practicing sitting and walking for 7 years, patiently waiting until finally, after 7 years, he hears a voice from the sky telling him that Dharmagata is about to emerge from his retreat and teach the holy Prajnaparamita teachings. And you can only imagine how overjoyed, after all this, Sataparuddha is. You know, he's so excited. And all the servants and everybody, they're running around, sweeping the ground and sprinkling water so there won't be any dust, and preparing everything for these teachings that are about to be given. Finally, Dharmagata emerges from his seven-year retreat, sits down on the Dharma seat carefully prepared for him, and now suddenly he's surrounded by hundreds of thousands of bodhisattvas, and he demonstrates the Dharma of the Prajnaparamita Sutra. And this is a quote from the sutra. This is the demonstration of the perfection of wisdom by the bodhisattva Dharmagata. The perfection of wisdom is self-identical because all dharmas are the same. Perfect wisdom is isolated because all dharmas are isolated. Perfect wisdom is immobile because all dharmas are immobile. Perfect wisdom is devoid of mental acts because all dharmas are devoid of mental acts. Perfect wisdom is unbenumbed because all dharmas are unbenumbed. Perfect wisdom has but one single taste because all dharmas have one and the same taste. Perfect wisdom is boundless because all dharmas are boundless. Perfect wisdom is non-production because all dharmas are non-production. Perfect wisdom is non-stopping because all dharmas are non-stopped. As the firmament is boundless, so is perfect wisdom boundless. As the ocean is boundless, so is perfect wisdom boundless. As Mount Meru shines in multicolored brilliance, so does the perfection of wisdom. As the firmament is not fashioned, so is perfect wisdom not fashioned. Perfect wisdom is boundless because form and the other skandhas are boundless. Perfect wisdom is boundless because the element of earth and the other elements are boundless. Perfect wisdom is self-identical because the adamantine dharma is self-identical. Perfect wisdom is undifferentiated because all dharmas are undifferentiated. This is how Dharmagata's discourse goes for many, many, many pages. I just read a little tiny bit. So now, Sataparuddha is even more overcome with joy, and he spontaneously enters into 6 million concentration states, corresponding to every detail of the teaching that he has just heard. In other words, he realizes for himself, in his own body, each one of these teachings and what they mean. Now, quoting again from the sutra, in conjunction with the acquisition of the 6 million concentration doors, Bodhisattva Sataparuddha saw the Buddhas and the Lords in all the 10 directions, in countless trichiliocosms. Nothing but Buddhas. Nothing anywhere but Buddhas. Each one surrounded by their congregation of monks and nuns. Each one accompanied by multitudes of bodhisattvas. Each one teaching just exactly this perfection of wisdom through just these methods, in just these words, in just these letters of the sutra, even as I now, in this great trichiliocosm, demonstrate Dharma. Surrounded by a congregation of monks, accompanied by multitudes of bodhisattvas, and teaching just this perfection of wisdom through just these methods, in just these words, in just these letters. Sadaprabhu, then became endowed with inconceivable learning and sacred knowledge, vast as the ocean. And from then on, in all his births, he was never again deprived of the Buddha. He was reborn only where he could be face to face with the Buddhas. He abandoned all unfortunate rebirths, and he had secured the circumstances which allowed him to accomplish one auspicious rebirth after another. The purpose of all these rebirths was to be of service to sentient beings in all the various realms and times in which he would be reborn. And that's the story of Sadaprabhu, and that's more or less the ending. The sutra in 8,000 lines. A happy ending. All Mahayana sutras have happy endings. And you can read this. It's a wonderful sutra. It will turn you inside out if you read the whole Prajnaparamita Sutra in 8,000 lines. Expertly, beautifully translated by the great and cranky Buddhist scholar Edmund Kanza, now deceased. Now, another story that I'm not going to tell you because it's too long, but I'll tell you a little bit about it. This is a story that I've also been contemplating of Rabbi Nachman, who was a mystic, a Jewish mystic, one of the most famous rabbis of all time. He lived in the late 18th, early 19th centuries in Ukraine. And he had quite a colorful life, and at one point in his life, he decided that he would give no other teachings but tell stories. He began to tell very outrageous stories. And recently, in Dharma Talks, I've been telling the story of Rabbi Nachman called the Humble King. And as I say, I'm not going to go into the whole story this time, but I will tell you that the story involves a very humble and very pure king who lives hidden in his palace in the middle of his country, which is a very, very corrupt country. And the idea is that this king is so pure and so humble that he cannot bear the corruption of his kingdom. And that's why he hides himself in the inner his palace, right in the middle of his kingdom, behind thick curtains, sitting there all by himself, so that no one has ever seen his face. So in my mind, these two stories rhyme with one another. And they say something important for me about our practice. In both stories, we have a portrait of a very pure and a very sincere person, an innocent person who doesn't know how to manipulate or organize things or persuade anybody about anything in order to get his way. Both these characters are like that, radically innocent and pure. And Sadaprabhu's emotion is so innocent and pure that he weeps when his desire to meet the great teacher is thwarted. And he's willing to do all kinds of outrageous things, like selling his own body in order to honor this teacher and receive the teachings. He has no thought whatsoever for his own welfare or advantage. And that's why in the end, he is able to receive the help he needs so that he hears the teachings and becomes liberated by them. To me, this story epitomizes the innocence and the ardor of the Bodhisattva. And I think that this is our aspiration in our practice, to be like Sadhaparudana, who just keeps going no matter what. Nothing can stop him. He's not looking to gain something. He's not cleverly manipulating things to make things work out the way he wants. I think that's how we practice. We just sit. And we keep on with our sitting. And in a very innocent way, you know, we trust our sitting practice, and we trust what happens, and we trust where it will take us. And we cry when we're sad. And we laugh with joy when we're happy. I think we are just like Sadhaparudana in our own way, innocent and impractical bodhisattvas. Practicing Zen is not the most practical thing a person can do. In the case of the humble king, we also have an innocent and pure person. But this person hides himself away rather than participate in the corrupt world, even though he is king of that very world. This humble king represents an innocence so pure, so tender, that it must remain hidden deep in the heart of the kingdom. So quiet, so deeply hidden, that no one has ever seen him. No one even knows he's there. It seems to me that we're like this too. Even though maybe we don't think of it this way, or we don't know it, or see it, I really believe, and I think you can see this, actually see it in each person, that everybody you will ever meet is, deep inside themselves, a pure and innocent soul who only wants goodness and truth and love, and is truly shocked and wounded by the world and all its cruelty. In other words, the child we once were, who was like that, is still in us, every one of us. But we all have to grow up. It's necessary for us to figure out how to be a person in this crazy and difficult world, to go forth among the other grown-ups and make our way. And it's stressful. It's inherently very stressful. It's not that there's something wrong. This procedure of growing up, going forth into the world and being somebody is inherently stressful, and it does violence to us in some way. It's so absorbing, so challenging. It actually causes us to forget about the pure soul that is inside of us all. We can lose track of it so utterly and so completely that we don't even know it's there. Maybe once in a while, in an unguarded moment, we bump into it, but we immediately dismiss it. I can't think like that. I'm a grown up. I can't see that in myself. I think the truth is we never really grow out of this innocence. We can repress it. We can bury it under a mountain of this and that. All our memories. many obligations and all the important things we're doing, all our fears, all our worries, huge amount of psychic energy it takes to live as a person in a world that is so big, and we are so small. As far as I can tell, Zazen, if we continue to practice, little by little, brings us good night. Thank you for coming. See you. I think when we practice Zazen, this is what's going on. Little by little by little, we're coming home to that person that's always been there in us, but that we've so deeply forgotten. It's such a relief to sit in silence, to return to the heart, to let go of all our calculations and complexities, and just be willing to sit here, just breathing, just willing to be alive as we are in this bright and perfect world. I remember Thich Nhat Hanh used to compare Zazen to a glass of pulpy orange juice. All the pulp is swirling around, so the liquid appears cloudy, but then you just set the glass down. Don't move the glass, just set it down. And if you let it alone, don't do anything, the pulp will settle to the bottom, and the liquid will appear to be pure and clear. It's not that the murky pulp somehow goes away, or is eliminated, but when it settles, everything is different. Sometimes when I'm explaining to people how to do Zazen, I'll say, just return your awareness over and over again to your body and your breathing, and you'll see, immediately when you do that, immediately, you look closely, there's a quality of stillness just in returning awareness. Maybe you still have thoughts and other things going on. But even so, when you return your awareness to your breathing and your body, there's a quality of stillness that can even be a little startling. And if there's a room full of people sitting together doing this, you can walk into that room and you can feel the stillness. It's very palpable. And what is it? It's nothing really. Right? I mean, what is stillness? It is exactly nothing. It's more an absence of something than a presence of something. Just like all dharmas that fail to be produced. It's powerful. It's unmistakable. Because awareness itself is innocent and sincere and very still. It is quiet and it is healing. The story of Santa Purudita expresses the purity of our longing to be free from suffering, free from our broken selves in the broken world. Everybody has this. This is, I think, goes with being a human being. Different languages, different concepts for it, but we all have this longing at the heart of what we are. However much we've forgotten it, however much much we deny it, however much we don't even like it, or cynically don't think it exists, or work hard to run away from it, it's there. Once we sit for a while, we realize that everyone has this too, not just us. And that's how it is that we can love and trust everyone. As if they were ourselves. Even though we know they have all kinds of troubles and problems, and they make such trouble and difficulty. So rascally and horrible in a million ways, still we love them and trust them because we know who they really are. The story of the hidden king emphasizes how shocked we all are by the world and its corruptions. Maybe you can remember, I remember. When I realized, you know, that the world was full of strife and difficulty, and that it wasn't innocent the way I felt I was innocent, it was a shock. You can remember that moment, but even if you can't remember that moment, there was a moment when you realized, oh no. To be sure, is also full of beauty. I think that's why we love nature, because it is so beautiful, so innocent. In nature, even when there's killing, there's plenty of killing in nature because everything has to eat. Even the, you feel the wholeness of nature, the innocence. Seasons coming and going, things dying and being reborn. But in the human world, we're witness to so much karma that has distorted individuals and whole societies. The things we have done to one another are staggering. People are really damaged. And societies are deeply damaged, whole societies. We read the news every day and we see how urgent is the suffering in so many parts of the world, including right here, where we are so fortunate. We might even feel guilty. Somehow we escape the suffering in some way and maybe are a cause of the suffering of people in other places. Maybe that's true in a way. If we didn't intend it so to be so, maybe it's true. And this reality, whether we're conscious of it or not, is also in every one of us as a kind of unconscious knowledge. And it causes a lot of unease. This is. When we sit and return to our original nature, we feel something else. When we breathe and return awareness to our body, simply to our being alive as creatures in this world, we are returning in that moment to peacefulness, to belonging. We are returning to the innocence and purity we all had naturally as children, but lost when we had to grow up to be somebody. What do we have? Such ideas in our our mind or not, we do realize the teaching and the perfection of wisdom. And even if we sit and our mind is disturbed, we're still trying to settle that glass of orange juice and it's still pretty cloudy. And so, just in our making the effort to sit, to dedicate ourselves to that effort, and to do it together with others who are making the same effort and have the same kind of dedication, together in return. And it heals us. It heals those who come into contact with us. There's one line in one of the Pali Suttas that I always remember. It's in the Udana, I think, section of the Pali Canon. It says, this mind, O monks, is luminous, only it is obscured by adventitious defilements from without. This line expresses the faith that undergirds all of Mahayana Buddhism, including Zen. Faith that our true nature, our fundamental nature, is good, luminous, awakened, enlightened. Sometimes we describe Zazen as resuming our true nature, returning to our true nature, our Buddha nature. We're not producing a new nature. We're not doing battle with ourselves and winning. Just settling in our true nature, a luminous nature emerges. It's always intact from the first moment, even until the last moment. Only it has been defiled by adventitious defilements from without. Adventitious means not inherent, not built in. Things have happened, they just happen. So many things, lifetime after lifetime. But we can chant all my ancient twisted karma from beginningless greed, hate, and delusion, born through body, speech, and mind, I now fully avow. And we can avow it. Let it go, because we have within us this inherent purity. And that means all our wounds can be healed. Even the whole world can be healed, because we are fundamentally already healed. And our practice is to remember this. Our way is a bodhisattva way, so naturally we want to try to help in whatever way we can. We would like to make things better for sentient beings if possible. And this is our work every single day. In everything we do, there's so many ways to be helpful, to be of service. So I always say our practices, there's two practices, two parts, sitting down and getting up. We sit down again and again and again to remember who we are. We get up after each sitting. Express the Dharma through all our activity. So that's what I want to share with you tonight. We have a few minutes before we chat in the evening, and maybe have some tea. So if anybody has something to say, please, it doesn't have to be a question, it can just be something you're feeling or thinking about. And I will respond if I have anything. And that goes for the people online too, if somebody online has something. Yeah?
My name is Julian.
Julian. And, hi, Julian.
Hi. And I haven't been here in a while. And I remember making a definite choice to come here today. And I remember while meditating, trying to make as few choices as possible. You know, try not to choose to move, try not to choose to breathe manually, try not to Jesus would do anything except, you know, to let the body lock into the automatic choice of following the breath and sitting and hanging out there.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not doing a very good job of it. So I have kind of a question from two different perspectives. That is, what happens when a being makes a choice? And that can be either from the perspective of being, from the perspective of the world, or from any other perspective or lack thereof that you think of. And you can answer however you want.
When a being makes a choice, the entire cosmos is changed forever. Every choice.
Is there a possibility that without suffering, without delusion, we're able to experience this?
Mm-hmm. You're saying, is it possible that we could experience it without suffering and without delusion?
Yeah.
Well, that's a question that reminds me of something like a rabbit with horns, or a Catholic rabbi. In other words, it's impossible. You can't even imagine such a thing. It's not even a question you could ask, you know, because it's kind of like two opposites. We couldn't be alive without suffering. There would be no life without suffering and delusion. It goes with the package, I think.
So about 10 days ago, I was talking to somebody and they gave me this meditation to listen to. And I started listening to it, and in the middle of the meditation it says, be the observer.
Mm-hmm.
I found that to be incredibly helpful. You know, even this morning I was meditating, I was really struggling. I'm like, no, just observe.
Mm-hmm.
Just instantly relax. I was wondering if you could tell me why is that working?
Because you're a devious guy, I guess. I don't know. It sounds like the way you described it just now. It sounds like it freed you from. You're judging yourself and trying to push yourself into doing something that was not happening. It allowed you to just relax and be there. Is that right?
Yeah.
So I think that's the whole thing. It's the whole key is just to be there with your life. In Zazen, I think we can actually have a good chance of doing that. It's harder the rest of the time, but why couldn't we do that all the time? Maybe in Zazen, we're training ourselves to just sort of say, it's okay to be myself in this life. And things are happening, and I can be with those things that are happening, and they don't have to happen the way I want them to happen, or according to some standard that somebody else set up. They can just be as they are, and it's okay. And then all of a sudden, you feel joyful, and you feel like somebody took a giant weight off your shoulders, right? And I think that we would like to, and I think we can, through our practice, be alive like that all the time. And maybe you could say, in Zazen we're training, we have a very simple situation. Just you. You're not even doing anything. You're not even moving. If you could do it then you could extend that. And you can, you know. Maybe one more comment. Yeah.
I was wondering, do you think that Zazen is for everybody and that everybody should do Zazen?
No, I think that theoretically it's for everybody, but in actual fact, in this life, we have various characteristics and karma. And so in this life, I can imagine that somebody, it's not right for them to do Zazen, they do some other practice or no practice. So it has never been, when you think about it, I mean, in the whole history of the world, a very small percentage of the people have ever practiced in this way. And yet, I do feel like, I wonder if the world would still be around if someone practiced this way. So I'm grateful to all the people who in the past and in the present practiced this way, and it's possible that maybe we're holding the world up. So. But then again, so are other people too. Is there anybody online that would like to? Philip always has something going. I see Philip.
I have to turn on the sound for him.
Thank you for your talk, Norman. I was feeling the back to the beginning of the talk, the spirit of Sada Parutada, that. He really has an inspiration from the Perfection of Wisdom Sutra that brings him to tears and leads him on this journey. And how do you see that kind of emotion fitting in with how we live our life? There's something I'm not, and you may be expressing it, and I'm missing that. But there is something moving about how inspired he is by this teaching, and wanting to. To get closer to it, to make it a part of his life, is he talking maybe about? I mean, maybe that's obvious. The perfection of wisdom is Zazen. Is that what he's expressing? Do you think in this yearning to find this bodhisattva who. In person and listen, and so that he can be more and more embody the teaching, even if he has to wait 7 years before the bodhisattva finally speaks.
Yeah, I think his story expresses the yearning that we all have, you know, to practice, and the spirit that we have to keep on going.
Mm-hmm.
It's there's something about, like you say, it is very moving. I find it very moving, and you know. And even though the stories, Mahayana Sutra stories, are magical realism stories, given that, I find the same thing in many, many people that I meet in practice, have that same spirit. It might not look that way on the outside, maybe, but when you really talk to them and really see their hearts, they're that way. Many of us are that way. It's a beautiful thing.
Yeah. Thank you.
No, I know it's time to go, but there's one more hand up, and I don't know who the person is.
Hello.
Yes. Hi. So maybe Hello. You have the last. You'll be the last.
Okay. Or maybe I can be quick, and there could be someone else too. Thank you for the talk. Hello, everybody. I've just a question, Norman, if there is a way to get in touch with you, maybe through email, that you can share with the students here or with me.
Yeah, Diane and I were just talking that you sent me an email a while ago and I didn't answer you. I'm sorry.
Oh, no, you I know you were in the angle. I knew it. I was waiting for you to come to Canada to get in touch, but more in general also.
Anybody can email me through the Everyday Zen website, and it always gets to me. But, I get a lot of emails, and I have good intentions, and I think I do pretty well. But every now and then, I lose track of an email that I do intend. Yeah, you know how I have the Gmail, you know, and you put a star on it. But then there's like 1,000 stars. You know? And And then every now and then you go and look at all the stars and you do trio.
Oh, I...
You know, anyway.
I take so many.
Yeah. You have my email address and you can email me again. And Diane even told me what it was that you were emailing
okay,
me.
Great.
I'm happy to help in that way. And
Thank you. I think in Silicon Valley and also for myself, we all understand what you're talking about.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
People
I meet are busier than I am.
It's incredible. I think I've seen inbox with 6,000 emails or 10,000 emails, like the 10,000 lines of the Prajna Paramita. Thank you.
Anyway, sorry about that. And I kind of depend on people to invest in it because otherwise you have everybody mad at me constantly.
It's like Santa asking for an apology. Yeah, right. I didn't deliver your present.
Yeah, right. Sorry. I know you wanted this. I wanted this. Well, thank you, everybody, for coming and practicing. I think it's very important something that we practice. Keep the practice going. So, and those of you who might be newer, I will tell you the secret is that once we develop that sense of longing and dedication, you really want to keep it. That's when it gets good. That's when it gets good. Do we chant now?
Yeah.